I believe that if you celebrate diversity of culture, ethnicity, and religion, you will also have to welcome a growing diversity of speech. Mm-hmm. And more different way, diverse ways of expressing yourself if you believe in what you say. But quite to the contrary, most European politicians believe that, yes, we celebrate diversity of culture, but it means that we need less diversity of speech, which to me is very illogical. And I'm not willing to sacrifice freedom of expression on the altar of cultural diversity.
Today we're interviewing Fleming Rose of the Cato Institute and the author most recently of The Tyranny of Silence, how one cartoon ignited a global debate over the future of free speech. In 2005, while an editor at the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten, Rose commissioned a series of cartoons about the Prophet Muhammad as an exercise to stop self-censorship. Terrorists and extremists responded to the cartoons with violence, attacks on Western embassies, and riots, creating a death toll that reached at least 200, according to the New York Times. Rose is no rogue provocateur. He is one of the planet's most committed and articulate defenders of free speech, the open society, and enlightenment values of tolerance and universal rights. Fleming Rose, welcome.
Thank you for those nice words, Nick. It's wonderful to be here.
Let's take the pulse of free speech in the decade since the Muhammad cartoons came out. Since then, we've seen any number of violent reprisals against free speech, probably most catastrophically the gunning down of a good part of the staff of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, France. But we've also seen the continuing rise of hate speech laws in Europe and a stultifying climate rise on U.S. campuses and other college campuses. Are things good for free speech generally right now or not?
If we take the long-term historical view, yes, free speech is in better shape than in the 17th century or in the 18th century or even in the beginning of the 20th century. No doubt about that. But if we look in a shorter-term perspective, let's say the past 20, 30 years, I think free speech is in worse shape. Free speech is in bad standing. You can see it when you check out statistics. Freedom House puts out a report every year. Reporters Without Borders in Europe do the same thing, and other institutions. And the trend is the same all over. But for the past approximately 10 years, freedom of the press and freedom of speech is in decline. And I think that the new thing, I mean, we know China, we know Cuba, we know North Korea, Russia, where things usually are in bad shape. But the new trend is that freedom of expression is in decline, even in Western Europe.
So what forms does it take, say, in Western Europe? I mean, are reporters being, if not put in jail, are there legal actions against them, or is it a chilled atmosphere where people just don't talk about certain things?
It's both. I mean, just to give you an indication, in the first half of 2015, France, of all countries in the world, was the most dangerous place to live for a journalist.
Meaning that 12 people were being gunned down
in January 2015.
Yeah.
So that's of course not the case anymore.
Right.
But a couple of years ago, I interviewed the most famous French cartoonist, Plantu, who works for Le Monde, and I asked him, when was the last time a cartoonist was killed in Europe? And he couldn't recall. Mm. The only name he came up with was a Palestinian cartoonist who was killed in London in 1987, either by the Mossad or the PLO. But even Henri Daumier, the most famous French cartoonist who worked in the 19th century, he was sent to jail several times, but he came out and he continued mocking the king.
Right.
He was not killed. He was not physically threatened.
Where are the threats coming from? Are they exclusively coming out of religious intolerance? Is it Islamic jihadists? Is it broader than that?
It's far broader than that. And I think fundamentally it has all to do with our ability to manage diversity. Mm-hmm. In a world that is getting increasingly globalized. And I think that the debate about free speech is going on in a qualitatively new situation, driven by migration, the fact that people move across borders in numbers and at speed never seen before in the history of mankind, the consequence being that almost every society in the world right now is getting more and more diverse in terms of culture, ethnicity and religion. That's one factor. The second factor is the digital technology. The fact that what is being published somewhere is being published everywhere. And people can react to speech across cultures, but in a situation where speech loses context mm-hmm. and can be manipulated and exploited and for political ends. That's what happened to me.
Right, yeah, because there was a series of Danish imams who took the cartoons, added cartoons that never appeared or were never commissioned by you, and then toured the Middle East and stoked anger. And I guess
and they deleted the, and they deleted the context.
Right.
I mean, even in some Western countries, mm-hmm. the context got lost in the translation.
And I guess what you're saying with the French cartoonist in the 19th century, it was at least it was a Frenchman mocking the French king. It wasn't a it wasn't somebody from Syria. It wasn't somebody from Africa or America.
Yes. Yes. This has put a huge pressure on everybody to manage diversity.
Right.
And it turns out that we in the West are not very well equipped to deal with that. I think you are a little bit better at it in the United States, but in Europe, we have, in the 20th century, tried to build a sustainable peace through the creation of homogeneous nation states. Mm-hmm. After World War I, and after World War II. After World War I, we created a lot of new states.
Right, so this is like Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia,
Baltic states, dissolution of four empires, mm-hmm. the creation of new states.
And those were all kind of predicated, I mean, not accurately always, but with the idea that they were creating, Czechoslovakians, they're all the same. They will get along
exactly.
with each other.
It was Wilson's principle of the mm-hmm. right to self-determination
right.
of a nation. There were still minorities living on different territories,
right.
And after World War II, there was a huge population swaps basically mm-hmm. in Eastern Europe,
right.
Germans, Ukrainians, Poles,
right.
Romanians, Hungarians. Mm-hmm. They were moved across borders in order to create more homogeneous nations.
Right.
And that has been a kind of dirty secret of Europe mm-hmm. Because of fascism, because of Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
National identity has been a kind of suspicious thing.
So, well, and I guess in a European context, this helps explain why after World War II, when Turks started moving into Germany to work, it was not even a question that they would be offered German citizenship
or
migrants.
And right. jobs. And yeah. they came to work and to make a living.
Right. But they would never be German because Germany is for Germans.
Exactly. And yeah. diversity is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Diversity is painful mm-hmm. of ethnicity, religion, and culture, and also of opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And because of our historical legacy in Western Europe, we have been told that we should celebrate diversity. And I think that's great. I'm married to an immigrant myself. I've traveled around the world, and I think diversity is a great
right.
thing. But it's kind of becoming, not okay to admit that it's difficult.
Right.
Because if you say that, you're racist, you're xenophobic, and so on and so forth.
Well,
and I don't think that's necessarily the case. It's just very difficult.
So you're Danish, you grew up in Denmark, you go back centuries or generations, and then a new person comes and you're uncomfortable with something about them. And is that not xenophobic? Is it not racist? Or what is a way, how can you have an open conversation that doesn't immediately get taken up to the 10th degree where everybody is ready to pull a knife?
The United States has for decades been a melting pot mm-hmm. or a composition of very different
right.
people coming from very different cultures. And therefore what it means to be an American is a quite narrow definition. You have to accept a few basic rules in order to get a sense that you belong when you get citizenship. And even though you speak the language with a accent, people
right.
will not look strange at you
mm-hmm.
and think you're an outsider.
Right.
In Denmark, it's very different. Denmark and most European nation states, they were homogeneous nation states for centuries. Diversity is something that you have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is to be proud that you provide 1% of GDP to the UN development programs. So, we do everything for the third world. We support and fight poverty. Another thing is to have a neighbor next door who belongs to a different culture and has a different religion and maybe speak a different language from the outset.
From a U.S. perspective, it's really a 20th century phenomenon. The term the melting pot comes from a play that was written in the 1890s. The Statue of Liberty, which is now seen as an icon of immigration and refugees coming to the U.S., was actually sent by France in 1876. It's called Liberty Enlightening the World. It was about how France and the U.S. were built on Enlightenment principles that had nothing to do with immigration. And it was, of course, a very ugly period. In the 1920s, we went through a period of very xenophobic immigration laws. Before that, Asians, Chinese, and Japanese were kept out by law. So it hasn't been as easy in the United States.
And it also underlines my point that this is something that you have to learn.
Right.
It's not natural. I would say that most people, they have a natural instinct for freedom. Mm-hmm. You want to do your own thing and you don't want other people to interfere and stop you.
Right, and you're Danish, so you've been to Germany and you still believe that most people want to be left to do whatever they want.
Yeah, I belong to a different generation. Yes. I didn't fight in the Second World War. But the other thing is tolerance. The ability to live with things that you don't like is something that we have to learn.
Where are we supposed to learn these values? And what has happened that we're not kind of keeping up with that?
I think the concept of tolerance has been undermined. When I was exposed to the cartoon crisis, I was quite often being criticized, you know, being xenophobic, racist, intolerant, and so on and so forth. So I sat down and spent some time trying to understand what are we talking about. And I found out, in fact, that the concept of tolerance in the West has been turned on its head compared to the way it was understood when it came into the world after the wars of religion in the 17th century. It grew out of the religious wars when Catholics and Protestants were killing one another for decades. At some point, people decided, okay, this has been going on for long enough. We have to work out a way to be able to live together, even though we hate one another, and we believe that the other faith is blasphemous. So edicts of tolerance were adopted in different parts of Europe, and it meant that in the beginning, that Catholics and Protestants, they were living in the same country but in different towns. Later, they could live in the same town, but in different parts of the town. And finally, they lived in the same quarter, and today they live in the same building without paying notice. But basically, that kind of religious tolerance implied that, yes, I hate the Protestant religion. I believe it's a threat to my way of life, to what I believe in, to the political, social, and cultural order of a Catholic society. But nevertheless, I'm not trying to ban it, and I'm not trying to use violence, intimidation, and threats to shut them up.
Right.
Tolerance is not something, a demand that you put on the speaker. It's not a demand that you put on somebody who publishes a cartoon or writes a novel or paints a painting. It's on the one who watches a cartoon, watches a movie, reads a novel, that they don't tear it apart or they want to ban it or use violence against cartoonists. That is what tolerance is about. Today it means quite the opposite, you may have a right to say what you say, but if you're tolerant, you shut up.
Where does the violence and where does the banning come from? Because on the one hand, people will say, well, there's been an influx, you know, come on, let's stop being polite here. There's been an influx of Muslims from former European colonies or from, you know, parts of the world where we've, you know, our foreign policy has created problems, et cetera. But there's a ton of Muslims. And, as much as Catholics and Protestants disagreed with each other, you know, they're at least, they worship the same God, whereas Muslims are against this completely. But then also in places like Europe, David Irving, the Holocaust denier, was put in Austrian jail, not because he wasn't offending Muslims, he was offending, you know, people who had perpetrated the Holocaust by saying, you know, so where, Where is this all heading, or where is this coming from?
I think, you know, these are different issues.
Right.
If we take Islam first, I do think that Islam finds itself in a state of crisis. And I think it is paramount to Muslims in Europe, where I live, to work out a religious doctrine that is compatible with a secular, multi-religious, multicultural society. Because the jihadists and the people who are in favor of killing blasphemers or apostates, they find quotations in the Quran,
right.
and that's why the jihadists, they are quite strong ideologically, because they do make references based on earlier interpretations of the holy texts.
And they're not going to listen to a secular Westerner explain to them why their interpretation of their holy book is wrong. It really is going to come from within the Islamic community.
Yes, and in fact, a year ago, I had a conversation with Steve Bannon, mm-hmm. who is now
in charge of him.
The White House, and that was in fact one of our disagreements, because Bannon believes that we are at war with Islam,
right.
while I'm saying, no, we are at war with violent Islamists, in a hot war, and we are in a cold war with nonviolent Islamists mm-hmm. that do not believe in liberal enlightenment values. But we need believing Muslims on our side who stands up for secular democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. And we cannot win this battle without having them on our side to talk to their fellow Muslims.
Just to follow up on Bannon, does he believe in Western enlightenment values? Because he seems to be very much of a nationalist, that he wants to define America in much more narrow terms than historically we have been.
He believes that this is all, that the crisis of the West is due to the loss of a Christian identity. That this is the Judeo-Christian civilization not being able to defend itself. So he believes in reestablishing the church. I mean, the church is still, Christianity is still powerful in the United States, but in Europe it's on the wane, and Europe is getting more and more secular.
I always find it peculiar when Christians talk about a Judeo-Christian heritage, especially in a European context. Europe spent a good part of the 20th century trying to get rid of the Jews, so it's odd to claim that now.
And that speaks to the other point that you talked about with David Irving. I talked about Islam and the challenge to Islam, that they have to work out a new doctrine of blasphemy that doesn't imply that you have a right to kill blasphemers, and of apostasy. And I also think that they believe that the Quran is the revelation of God to Muhammad, and it put brakes on the right to discuss, to criticize and challenge religious dogma compared to Christianity and and the Bible. So I believe they do face big challenges, and it's spill into Europe. The other part of it is...
By the way, just to keep on Islam, but are you mostly describing kind of Arab Islam or Middle Eastern Islam as opposed to
Sunni,
say, Indonesia and Malaysia?
You don't...
I mean, they have their problems, but it just doesn't seem to be as constraining an entity on
identity.
But
it's also a problem in Turkey.
As somebody who knows very little about Islam, I tend to think of it as, you know, in its traditional origin lands of the Middle East or of the Mediterranean, but most of the world's Muslims live elsewhere, and
that is true.
In the same way that Catholics in South America and North America and Asia have very different practices and really different belief systems.
But nevertheless, the Pope is the key authority who is based in the Vatican in Rome, and it's the same with Islam, because the Quran was written in Arabic.
It emanates from there.
So the Arab world enjoys an authority that Indonesia doesn't when it comes to interpretations and tradition, and you have the holy sites in Saudi Arabia and so on and so forth. But I get your point, and I think it's true that there are parts of the world where you have Muslim majority countries that do not have the same do not experience the same kind of pressure as they do in the Muslim Arab world. That is true.
What's going on with the rise of speech codes to say, you know, to get rid of hate speech, to, you know, ban certain types of words, certain types of expression? Clearly, that's not being driven by, you know, it's not like Islamic people are calling the shots in Vienna, right?
No, that's true. And this goes back to my point about our lacking ability to manage diversity. I believe that if you celebrate diversity of culture, ethnicity, and religion, you will also have to welcome a growing diversity of speech, and more different way, diverse ways of expressing yourself if you believe in what you say. But quite to the contrary, most European politicians believe that, yes, we celebrate diversity of culture, but it means that we need less diversity of speech, which to me is very illogical. And I'm not willing to sacrifice freedom of expression on the altar of cultural diversity. I think it's absurd. But that drives the push for new and new laws, because most politicians in Europe believe that in order to save the social peace when we are getting more and more diverse, we need more and more bans. We need to speak more and more quietly. We need to be reluctant to express what we really believe or think about people who live their lives in a different way. So I really think it's absurd, and I don't get the logic. But nevertheless, that is a trend, and for the past 10 years, there's been a push for expanding hate speech laws. There's been a push from the European Union to impose on every member state laws criminalizing denial of the Holocaust.
Right.
It has led to a reaction in Eastern Europe. Yes, they passed these laws, but they also passed laws criminalizing denial of the crimes of communism. And you have a law in Switzerland criminalizing denial of the Armenian genocide. You have Ukraine passing laws criminalizing criticism or mocking of Ukrainian freedom fighters in the 20th century. And in Russia, where they criminalized criticism of the behavior of the Soviet Union during the Second World War. But this, it all goes back to the European memory laws criminalizing denial of the Holocaust. And this belief that you protect memory through legislation about history is a very authoritarian idea.
Sure.
And it's being copied in Bangladesh, it's being copied in Rwanda. Most European countries have also criminalized what they call glorification of terror, which is a way of criminalizing opinion. And so just to give you one example of how absurd it is, because it relates to the United States. After 9/11, a Basque newspaper published on its front page a cartoon of the planes crashing into the Twin Towers, and it read, we all dreamt about it, but Hamas did it. It was a factual error, because it wasn't Hamas, and it's outrageous, it's offensive to me and to you, I suppose.
To Hamas, even.
Yeah, to Hamas, yes. But I mean, and he was convicted for glorification of terror. And it was, in fact, confirmed by the European Court of Human Rights that it was okay to convict this cartoonist. So this is spreading, and the most recent thing is the push within the European Union for criminalizing fake news.
Right.
And leading German politicians, Italians, even Danes, are talking about equating fake news with hate speech.
And how do they go about defining fake news in that? Because ultimately that means kind of licensing journalists or having some kind of verification process, which puts the government in control or some government agency
in control.
It
basically leads to a ministry of truth,
right?
If you want to take it, you know, to its end, because it's up to the government to decide what is fake news and what is not. And I think it also undermines the mainstream media, the old media, because if they can publish, if they are not, you know, prosecuted for publishing fake news, they are in a way, on the side of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me a little bit of the times of the Soviet Union, where you had Pravda and Izvestia, government-sanctioned news, that in the end nobody believed, because they were lying about everything. And the Samizdat, the unofficial, the underground press, no matter whether they fact-checked or not, they were more reliable in the eyes of the public.
And of
and
course...
So it means that this will have the opposite effect, because they say frankly, well, two factors. They want to defend themselves against Russian hackers and Russian trolls and so on and so forth. I understand that, but I just think it's the wrong way to go about it. The other thing that they fear is the rising populist parties, and they make they don't hide that this is the enemy that they are going after when they are going after fake news.
And then that becomes a tremendous propaganda win for the populist parties and the trolls.
You couldn't dream of...
You lived in the Soviet Union?
Yes.
And is it credible that Russia, that the government of Russia is orchestrating these kind of soft power campaigns of influence that cross a line from simply kind of, you know, wanting Trump to win or wanting, you know, a particular candidate in England to win, to crossing the line into something that is more like espionage, or is that overblowing it?
I don't know. But I think Russia is trying to make its influence as we are trying to make. We are also hacking into Russian computers, and the Chinese are hacking into computers everywhere.
Well, of course, the United States has a stake in every election in the
world,
and usually makes it known.
Yeah. They make no. So it's a little bit hypocritical, you know, screaming and yelling about the Russians as if they are the only ones who are doing this.
Right.
Look at yourself.
Yeah.
So in a way, they're copying.
No, but we were only listening to Angela Merkel's phone calls because, you know, that was important. You know,
exactly.
It's well here.
And I think that the Russian digital threat is overblown. I think the main threat against the Enlightenment values and our liberal society comes from within and not from without. But it's very easy to point the finger at a scapegoat instead of looking at yourself.
And of course you say, well, Russian trolls, so we have to control the press here. It actually speeds up our process of getting rid of Enlightenment values.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the kind of paradox that you were saying, and I think you're right, that the world is becoming more diverse. Every country is becoming, you know, basically more diverse. Europe is a more diverse place than it was 100 years ago. And yet, at the same time, you would expect that, especially as the birthplace of the Enlightenment, that people would be more comfortable with difference, with racial difference, ethnic difference, religious difference, gender difference. But we're seeing this resurgence of nationalism. Is that being driven, and particularly within an open Europe now? I mean, because 100 years ago, there was no unified concept of Europe other than that, well, we knew we weren't Turkey. But other than that, all of the European countries were trying to kill each other.
Mm.
Now we have this unanimity of Europe, but within that, nationalism is on the rise. How do we get back to that kind of celebration or understanding of the Enlightenment where you can both be a citizen of the world and a citizen of your home country, your hometown, your family?
It has to do with the fact that Enlightenment values like reason, tolerance, free and independent individuals have been undermined for a very long time. It didn't start with Trump. In fact, the whole concept of postmodernism that you know, anything goes, Islamic values are as good as Enlightenment values, and so on and so forth, has led to this relativism. And I think it has a lot to do with the value we provide to emotions. That if you feel something, if you can identify some kind of emotional attachment to whatever it is, then logical arguments of reason, they don't count in the same way. In some way, it's in reaction to globalization, that people feel sometimes disenfranchised, sometimes alienated, they don't know who they are, they have lost a sense of community, and that is also important to individuals. And for a very long time, a healthy sense of of national belonging was suspicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are different kinds of nationalism.
Right.
You can love your country without being xenophobic. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, I think in Western Europe, it was kind of suspicious. Mm-hmm. So you see a reaction that is spilling over, you know, to the other end of the spectrum, and then at the same time you have this mass migration into Europe that makes people feel uncomfortable, and we haven't been able for a long time to have an honest conversation about mm-hmm. that, and that has been exploited by these populist forces. I would have preferred that the mainstream parties wouldn't have shied away from talking about this in a frank and clear manner, instead of trying to suppress the issue.
Do you think that the in a European context, will the European Union be a place where a kind of more where the West can get out of a kind of defensive crouch, a feeling that it is being embattled by all of these other forces, possibly also by economic competition, which is in, you know, is probably driving some of this as well, but into a more confident and forward-looking embrace of this, you know, original understanding of Enlightenment, universalism, and tolerance? Or are institutions like the EU part of the problem?
They are part of the problem and part of the solution. For many years, it worked the way you explained, that the European Union was a force of sound integration and cooperation. But I think more and more people feel alienated by Brussels. A lot of decisions that didn't have to be taken down there have been taken down there, and it's far away. It's not, you know, it's not close to your own community. And the European Union is also a very comfortable scapegoat for national politicians, so they don't have to blame themselves. If they can blame Brussels, it's a lot easier. But it's just a fact of life now that the European Union is experiencing a crisis of legitimacy. And we have to pay notice. And I think one of the starting challenges with the European integration project was that it was not in any way, the end goal was not identified in any way. It was identified as a never-ending process of integration. Usually when you have an organization, you have to solve a problem or manage a situation. But this was a kind of postmodern project, you know, that goes on and on and on, and we never see some final point. Another thing is that the European Union for many years didn't have real growth.
Yeah, and I suspect that's a huge, and people will acknowledge it in the US, but the difference between averaging 2% economic growth of GDP each year versus 3% is massive.
Yes.
And we're in, if not quite a contraction, a flatlining that is.
But people around 2% is a problem for you, but in Europe that would be great.
Well, as a final thought, what are the projects that you're working on for the Cato Institute? You've joined them, and what can we look forward to from you going forward?
I'm going to write a book for Cato about free speech in a multicultural society, a short book, 15,000-20,000 words, to explain the basics of this, and hopefully I will do video and audios, so it can be included somewhere
in the last free university.
Exactly.
Right? Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank you very much for talking to us. We have been talking with Flemming Rose. He's the Danish journalist, now with the Cato Institute, the author most recently of The Tyranny of Silence, and a wonderful incarnation of universal values, particularly for tolerance, pluralism, and free expression. Thank you again for talking to us, Flemming.
Nice to be here, Nick.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.